This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. There are 12 candidates in the race and 4 days before the preliminary vote to replace Tom Menino. Endorsements are flying, poll results are circulating, and candidates are campaigning at a fever pitch. Just try to go anywhere in the city without seeing blank for mayor yard signs.
At the state level, Attorney General Martha Coakley glad hands outside Fenway Park as she kicks off her campaign for governor. And there's also a scramble on to fill the congressional seat vacated by now Senator Edward Markey.
It's a politics-heavy week in review this week with Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page editor of the Boston Globe. Dante, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
And also a welcome back to John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Hi, John.
Hi, Tasha.
So all of these candidates are going to have to deal with the legacy of Mayor Menino. And as we've heard, and as Dante the Globe has written about, there have been a real flurry of major development projects being approved in Menino's last months in office. In fact, I think it was just this morning that the New York Times had a story with the headline, Building a Legacy with Construction Cranes, in terms of Menino. So last night, there was a mayoral forum sponsored by WBUR, UMass, and the Boston Foundation. The topic of housing came up at that. Here is candidate Bill Walczak talking about Mayor Menino's plan to add 40,000 low-income housing units to the city.
But one of the things that's really missing from this is good rate, not market rate, and not low-income housing. It's that middle housing that's really missing from this. There's so many people that cannot afford to live in Boston who are neither rich nor poor.
And actually, what Menino proposed was 30,000 units. I believe 5,000 of those were going to be sort of moderate income, so a fairly modest amount. Dante, would you give us a sense of how in this campaign, housing is sort of both an issue for the mayor's legacy, but also becoming a very first agenda item for the new mayor?
It's a perpetual agenda item here in Boston just because the cost of housing is so high. And what's interesting about the dialogue about it in the course of the campaign is that the city's traditional approach toward this has been to try to promote the creation of a lot of subsidized housing units, low-income housing units. But it's also becoming clear that there are a whole other group of people, whether it's families who are of moderate incomes or people who are fresh out of college, who also need places to live. In other cities, the way that people would handle that is just go out and buy rent an apartment somewhere. So, the discussion is evolving a little bit towards people saying that maybe Boston just needs to build more. And certainly Menino's housing plan reflected that idea, the idea of building higher and more densely than some previous efforts of his administration. And you hear echoes of that in the way at least some of the candidates are talking about that on the trail.
We've also been hearing some of the candidates push back a little and say, well, wait a minute, stop approving or suggesting or sort of proposing all these major ambitious projects in your final few months in office because the new mayor could be handcuffed by those. John Carroll, do you feel like that's a legitimate concern among these candidates?
I think it is, partly in the housing department, but definitely in the school superintendent area. Tom Menino should not be appointing a new school superintendent that another mayor is going to have to live with. And I think time's growing short, so I don't think that's necessarily going to happen. The housing, whoever thought that Tom Menino was going to be a proponent of tiny houses? He wants the 300-square-foot apartments downtown. I think that that's an interesting sort of proposal and direction. But one of the big issues is Boston going to become like New York, which is a town that's too expensive for people to live in? And that's the direction it's heading in right now. And I think that's one of the concerns of most of the candidates in the field is, can people afford to live in Boston?
Right. We've heard several candidates use that Tale of Two Cities line and the idea that we recognize there's a possible crisis. How is the new administration going to deal
right.
with it? Also in last night's forum, there was a question during the lightning round posed by moderator Bob Oakes, our Morning Edition host, about the future of the Boston Police Department.
Ed Davis is the Boston Police Commissioner. You are either in favor of him staying, in favor of him leaving, or you're undecided. Bill Walczak, which is it?
Staying.
John Connolly.
Undecided.
Charles Yancey.
Leaving.
John Barros.
It needs a full review.
Charlotte Kolar-Ritchie.
Undecided. Full review.
Staying.
Felix Arroyo. Stay, did you say?
Yes, yeah, staying.
Charles Clements.
Leave. Look at his track record.
Michael Ross.
Undecided.
Dan Connolly.
Staying.
Full review. Full review, undecided.
Okay, thank you.
John Carroll, I'm interested generally what you think about these responses. How much political posturing going on or something else? How would you? How
there
would
are
you...
some profiles in courage, huh? The courage to be undecided about whether Ed Davis should stay or go. I think that it's a tricky issue, and I think that they don't want to get involved in it. And this is one of the problems with the 12-candidate field, is that there's been very little debate. There's been very little differences of substance, and there have been a number of issues that they have just dodged, pretty much, and they dodged this one.
And I'd like to have Dante weigh in on this, but we're having a little trouble with our connection with the Globe. So, John, I'm going to go on to you, and hopefully we'll have Dante back with us.
I certainly hope so.
So another hot topic in the mayor's race is the plan to bring casino gambling to eastern Massachusetts. And we also heard last night during the debate that some candidates are already beginning to sort of count on the money that they hope will come in from the casino projects. This was what Charlotte Golar Ritchie had to say about that.
There will be a lot of ways that I would want to use that $32 million, I think, is what is expected to come in on annual revenues that I would want to use for job creation, for job training, a variety of things.
Now, John, can you give us some sense of whether you think that kind of revenue projection, $32 million, is just overly optimistic? Because there was a reporter from the Globe who asked a gambling expert about this, and that expert just laughed out loud. You know, he said that for a city to make that kind of projected return, Suffolk Downs would have to generate more gambling revenue than any other casino in the country.
Yeah, and I don't think that's going to happen. So I think the candidates have already spent that $32 million three times, and it's not even going to be $32 million. So I think that that's one of the issues that has to be resolved, is what does this really mean in terms of revenue for the city of Boston? Because that should be clear to people when they're going to vote on whether they want a casino in East Boston or they want a casino in Everett, wherever it might be. I think the revenue coming in, and then I think the way they divvy it up is going to be depending on whatever their pet causes are.
And Dante Ramos, I believe we have you back.
I'm back.
Glad to hear it. You know, one thing we've heard in particular from Bill Walczak, who of course says he will stop a casino if he becomes mayor, and from Dan Conley, the Suffolk County DA, who says just a full debate hasn't happened on this very serious issue. What kind of pushback are we seeing? Even as these giant casino proposals are in the works, we have candidates saying, wait a minute, we haven't really talked about this as much as we can, particularly in terms of social cost.
There has been a funny dynamic here, because from the outset, Mayor Menino and a lot of other powers that be in the city have been strongly, strongly supportive of a casino at Suffolk Downs, so much so that a lot of other people have shrugged their shoulders and said, well, I guess that's how it's going to be, and therefore there hasn't been really much of a citywide debate, as you're saying, about it. And the way that the casino bill has been structured is that only East Boston gets to vote on it. So at this late date, I think the what you're hearing from Bill Walczak reflects that at least there is a perception that there are some people who feel that this has just been rammed through. What you don't hear, at least what I don't hear a lot of around town, is people having a strong expectation that much is going to change on that issue, and that the casino or that the Suffolk Downs plan is going to be voted on citywide. I mean, there is a feeling that maybe it's too late to stop that, unless somebody like Bill Walczak gets elected mayor, I guess.
And Dante, another question for you about the Globe endorsements. This week, the Globe came out and endorsed John Barros and John Connolly. And I thought this was an extremely thoughtful editorial. I mean, it was really the entire half the page. You very much went through all the candidates, talked about their strengths and weaknesses, talked about some of them having potential, but maybe being a little young, someone who eventually would make a good candidate. So give us sort of the quick overview of why you ultimately chose Barros and John Connolly as your endorsements.
Well, if you read the editorial endorsement, it's not just, or at least we hope, it's not just a long broadside in favor of those two candidates. It's part of an overall theory of the race that we kind of began developing earlier this year. We had a series of editorials about needing to open up the city's political culture and civic culture and economic life. And in a way, the mayoral endorsement followed from that to some degree, because the principles that we put forth earlier that year and that are reflected in the editorial is that there's a certain agenda for the city, and we measured various candidates according to how well they seemed equipped to carry that out. And there are lots of other issues that you look at, but by and large, both Barros and Connolly, in different ways, both seem, at least it seemed to us, to be well poised to carry out a progressive agenda in the way that we had outlined it. If you read the editorial, and it's quite long, there are other candidates who are also showing promise in that way. So, you know, as I said, it wasn't our intention to, you know, have propaganda in favor of Barros and Connolly, but rather a sort of analysis that shows why it is that these two look like, for a certain set of values, they're the best embodiment.
Right, and that's why I thought the editorial was particularly thoughtful, because you really took time to evaluate each candidate. And John Carroll, I want to read you part of the Globe endorsement. It says, "This year's mayoral campaign has been an unexpected revelation, a demonstration in itself of Boston's growth and maturity. Candidates have emerged who not only reflect the homegrown values of those communities, but project a larger, more inclusive vision for the city. It's an outstanding field that has pieced together something approaching a common agenda." I'm wondering if you agree that this is an impressive field, for the most part, of 12 people running.
I think it's an interesting field. I think that there are a lot of interesting candidates there, and I think that, it's provided a lot of range for the voters to look at. I'm not sure I think as highly of the candidates as the Globe does, but just because we live in a two-daily town, let me just say really quickly that the Herald endorsed, in a much shorter endorsement, endorsed Suffolk DA Dan Connolly and City Councilor John Connolly. But the really interesting thing about the Herald endorsement was a non-endorsement that they issued, the anyone but a non-endorsement for Marty Walsh. So they were really campaigning against Marty Walsh while they were endorsing the other two candidates.
John and Dante, I'm wondering how much you think endorsements really matter in this race. I mean, it's 12 people. It requires a lot of homework for people to cast a smart vote. Just last night, I was driving through West Roxbury and Roslindale and Hyde Park, and there were campaign signs everywhere for all of them. So you just see a lot of interest in a lot of candidates. I'm wondering if you think, how influential is an endorsement in this kind of race?
My general view is that in a race that is as fractured and as tight as this, where you have 12 candidates and the polls all seem to show them being kind of clustered, or the leaders being clustered in the 10 to 15 to 20% vicinity, there's a lot of room for people to find a candidate who could potentially get into the final. And I think voters, you know, seeing that broader field, probably more so than in, say, the presidential election, probably can use a little bit more help from voices that they trust in assessing who these people are. I mean, they obviously don't get a chance to know them as well as if there were only four candidates. Now, you know, I wouldn't pretend that the fact that we made an endorsement of two candidates, everybody else is just going to say, oh, okay, well, we're just going to, you know, forget about it and vote for who the Globe says you should vote for. At the same time, people who generally like our positions, or at least read our editorials and think that there is, you know, an iota of sense in them, will, you know, hopefully weigh that in making their decision.
I don't want to disagree. I would just say that in the voters' information environment, I don't think that newspaper editorials rank all that highly. I think there are a lot of other players above that. That being said, if a newspaper editorial makes a good argument for a candidate, I mean, that can be effective. It's not just that the Globe said John Barros and John Connolly. If they put forth a good argument and people absorb it, I mean, that can have an effect on how people vote.
What about the Boston Teacher Union endorsement this week? Bay Windows, the GBLT newspaper endorsed Mike Ross. What about those other endorsements?
I mean, you look at the Boston Teachers Union, and half the people say it's the kiss of death, and the other half of the people say this is great. I mean, the Teachers Union is really fraught with peril in terms of associating yourself with it, because there are a lot of people who feel very strongly that the Boston Teachers Union is obstructionist, and they are actually doing harm to children rather than helping them. So I think that it comes with a price.
Of course, in the end, only one person goes to the mayor's office, which means there are 11 people left behind who many people think have a lot of promise. Do the two of you think there's any chance that some of these other people who will lose will end up in the cabinet or having some other role in city government? Will the new mayor be benevolent and bring in some of his former competitors?
I would hope so. And I think that at least from what I've observed, the tone of this campaign has actually been quite positive. And you see these candidates, they've been to so many forums together. They're interacting in a very happy and cheerful way. There doesn't seem to be a ton of bad blood between them. So it wouldn't be that hard to imagine somebody who was a losing candidate becoming, you know, if they could subordinate their ego long enough to not take the top job, to be an important person in the eventual mayor's cabinet.
I think anybody who wins the mayor's race in Boston should bring John Barrows and Felix Arroyo in the next day. Those two have real star potential, and I think that they would be a great addition to any cabinet.
There is a governor's race going on, too, of course. And this week, Attorney General Martha Coakley announced her bid. She told reporters that she has learned valuable lessons from her defeat against Scott Brown in the race for U.S. Senate.
My biggest regret in that was the perception people had during that race, that somehow I didn't work very hard or that I didn't care. I know that in that race, and I know now, that I have to earn the respect of every voter in Massachusetts. I'm working, starting out with this campaign today and every day to the primary, to make sure that I talk to voters about their concerns and fears.
And John Carroll, how different of a candidate do you expect to see from this version of Martha Coakley in this race?
We've already seen a different candidate. She went over to Fenway Park to shake hands. So, I mean, this is like the mulligan tour for Martha Coakley. It's all a big do-over. And everything she did wrong in 2010 running against Scott Brown, she's going to reverse this time. I think overall in the three years since that race, the special election that she lost, I think that she's done a good job rehabilitating herself. I think she's done a good job reestablishing herself as a respected candidate, a politician, statewide office holder. So I think she's in a good position. I don't think Charlie Baker is her big problem right now. I think Steve Grossman and possibly Michael Capuano are her big problem right now.
Dante, another candidate is State Senator Dan Wolf, the founder of Cape Air, who had to suspend his gubernatorial campaign until the State Ethics Commission resolved this issue about whether his CEO-ship of Cape Air was a problem because of the contracts it had with Logan. Yesterday they said he could stay in the Senate. It's not a conflict in their view. Do you think we will see him as a candidate back in the governor's race ballot?
I'm sorry, do you think we'll see...
Will we see him unsuspend his campaign and jump back into the governor's race?
I suppose it's possible. The problem with the ethics decision is that they were quite definitive about it the first time around. It happens. I'm not sure that case was rightly decided exactly, in the sense that it would seem to preclude almost anybody who has a certain set of business interests from running for state offices. And now they've given him a little bit of a reprieve, but it would take a pretty significant walk back on their part. Now, maybe he's gotten some kind of assurance that's a possibility, but from what a lot of people have said, it would take a change in the law or again a very significant change of heart by the ethics board, really a sort of never mind, we were wrong, in order to undo the reason he was getting off the ballot in the first place.
I want to bring in one more race going on, which is the contest to fill the congressional seat vacated by Ed Markey. Now, there are 10 candidates who've launched bids, but this week one person got a lot of attention with a new ad, and this is Carl Shortino.
I'm Carl Shortino, and I'll never forget that conversation with my dad.
That's me.
Where I had to come out and tell him.
Wait for this.
That I was a Massachusetts liberal.
And he's proud of it.
Dad's in the Tea Party.
Damn right. It was bad enough him taking on the big banks and corporations in the legislature.
They weren't paying their fair share in taxes.
And he wrote the buffer zone law.
To protect women entering abortion clinics from harassment.
It's gone all the way to Supreme Court. I was kind of proud of that.
But here's the one that drives him crazy.
He wants to go to Congress to take on the NRA and a Tea Party.
So, John Carroll, what's your take? What's your grade for that ad?
I give it an A. It's a really good ad. And it comes at a really good time because it's quiet now. It's relatively quiet. Overall, and in this particular race for the fifth. So it comes at a really good time. And coincidentally, one of the other candidates in the Democratic primary, State Senator Catherine Clark, she has an ad out with her mother in it. Her mother talking about how she suffered gender discrimination when she was a young woman trying to get into the workforce. But the difference between the two, Catherine Clark has had 1,800 views on YouTube. Carl Shortino has had 284,000 views on YouTube.
All right. In the few minutes we have left, let's do our hubbubs, that little news story that sort of slipped through the cracks for many people. John, you do have one this week you want to mention?
I do have one this week. Martha Coakley jumped into the race. Emily's List, the liberal women's rights group, jumped right in after her and endorsed her. And on their website, they had her featured with a photo, and it says, Martha Coakley, we've just endorsed Martha in her race to be the worst woman elected governor in Massachusetts. Show her that we're fighting to make history with her. Now, of course, they meant first woman, but they had worst woman. They corrected it pretty quickly, but nobody corrects it fast enough to avoid the screenshot, the inevitable screenshot that somebody had and circulated.
So they need a copy editor or a better copy editor.
much better copy editor.
And Dante Ramos?
Turn off autocorrect.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. Dante, your hubbub?
So several leading candidates for mayor are now in their early 40s, but they have not let go of the quintessential Generation X way of trash talking, which is to say cutting on each other's musical tastes. Before a recent campaign forum here at the Globe, Mike Ross was mocking Rob Consalvo, who is a diehard fan of this band.
Okay, and that is the Smiths, is that right?
That is the Smiths, the fabulously gloomy band of the 1980s. Now, at the same forum, John Connolly said that he preferred a much harder sound like this. Black hole sun, won't you come?
Wash away the rain. And Dante, that is?
So that, for those who weren't wearing flannel in the 90s, was Soundgarden. And just yesterday, John Connolly was tweeting about them to reporters who were following Consalvo around. Now, there's something that is totally, totally middle school about this, but to me it's also progress when votes turn on not ethnicity or ideology, but on which band is cooler.
And Meghna, your hubbub.
Okay, so I had a big, long hubbub, but in light of what Dante said, my hubbub is going to be, I want all the mayoral candidates to listen to the second half hour of Radio Boston today, because we're going to have really good music that maybe they ought to consider for their campaigns. I will say no more.
And I want to mention something that's slightly old news because it happened in late August, but I wish that it had come up in last night's mayoral forum, which is that in late August, two kittens escaped on the tracks in the New York City subways. The subways were shut down for an hour to rescue the kittens. And what's even better is that the New York Daily News called the mayoral candidates and said, would you have shut down the subways to save the kittens? A question no politician wants to answer. So I wish, Meghna, last night at the panel, that question had come up. And we would have said, if kittens escaped on the T, would you have shut down the T to save the kittens?
It would have been a good lightning round question.
The way the T runs, you wouldn't even have to shut it down. It would just let it go on in business as usual.
Exactly. That's Dante Ramos of the Boston Globe and John Carroll of Boston University. Thanks for coming both in.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Stick with us, because in a few moments we'll have The Deadly Gentleman, that band that I was teasing you about a little earlier. But up next, a local photographer documents tattoos that memorialize the Boston Marathon bombing. This is Radio Boston.